I realized on my drive in here this morning, I'm really beginning to like Georgia. As Jess mentioned, I live in Louisville, Kentucky now, and you realize I pronounced it correctly. Because I lived there before when I was in seminary, but I'm from the West Coast, really. I grew up in Arizona, went to college in California, came to seminary in Kentucky, went back to Arizona, back to California, and now I'm back in Kentucky. So my wife said, if we ever move again, let's just skip Arizona and go straight to California, because she's from Arkansas and doesn't really like the desert. But I've spent a little bit of time in Georgia because the BCC hosts our annual leadership summit in Rome, and I really like it. But on my way here, I realized I like Georgia because you guys are very common sense people in naming of your street names. And I'm just a non-creative, common sense namer of things. So my boys' stuffed animals are Big Puppy, Little Puppy, Blue Puppy, and we even have a Preppy Puppy because he has a scarf. And so there was Mall of Georgia Road, right? Peachtree Road. And then this amazing street I'm curious about called Sugarloaf. And if I have a huge sweet tooth, so during the break I need somebody to explain to me what a Sugarloaf is, and then I'll probably like Georgia even better. So thank you very much for hosting us. I'm really excited to be here. Jess gave you a little bit of an introduction to myself. I'll introduce myself a little bit more throughout the day as well. So Rachel is here with us as well. Just to clarify, some people had a little confusion. Rachel's not my wife.
No.
Nothing against Rachel at all. She's a dear friend, great lady, but she's not my wife. My wife's name is Jenny, and she's at home with our two boys, Reed and Dashiell. But Rachel has phenomenal interest and understanding and background in post-traumatic stress and a particular thing that she'll talk about a little bit later in the day called complex PTSD. And Rachel and I met at the ABC conference, which is the Association of Biblical Counselors Conference, in the spring this year, and she was teaching on that topic. So when I was talking to Ty about the possibility of coming down and doing this workshop, I wanted to bring in other speakers besides myself for a few reasons. One, I didn't want to talk all day. Two, I wanted you to get some different perspectives on things, and the reason I wanted Rachel to be here in particular is to address the issue of complex PTSD, but also to highlight the fact that this is not, and I'll talk about this more, this is not a military issue, this is not a first responders issue, this is a human issue. And her background working with internationals as well as women in particular who've been in abusive relationships will help expand that idea a little bit. So just to tell you, who is this guy and why should I listen to him? I don't know if I'll be able to answer the second question adequately, but my name is Curtis Solomon. I'm the director of the Biblical Counseling Coalition. I'll explain the BCC a little bit more at lunch, but the reason I'm interested in post-traumatic stress and why, maybe not why you should listen to me, but hopefully you'll listen to the Word of God and what He has to say about this issue. I think you're here because you understand the importance of that issue. It's a weighty one. It's a heavy one. And it's something that is a growing awareness in our world, even though it's been something that's existed since Adam and Eve ate fruit. The wrong fruit. I'm sure they were eating fruit before that. And the reason have a particular interest in it, one is I am a veteran. I'm not a combat veteran, so I make that distinction not because any veteran is less than any other. Anybody who's raised their hand and sworn to protect their country deserves honor and respect, but I do think there's a different level of respect I personally give to combat veterans, and I don't want to claim that for myself. Besides being a veteran and seeing brothers and sisters in arms wrestling with this issue, I went to work for the Department of Veterans Affairs after seminary, and I was helping process compensation and disability claims for veterans. And in particular, when I was in the Phoenix office, I was in charge of handling the cases that were coming straight out of the military. So there was a Department of Defense, Department of the VA program to help try to smooth that transition. And I saw a lot of, we call them GWAT veterans, Global War on Terror vets, coming through and seeing so many diagnoses of post-traumatic stress disorder, and then also seeing the debacle, whatever you want to call it, of how the VA was oftentimes handling the issue. And it just grieved my heart that even the best treatment out there that the VA could provide never got to the deepest needs that these people had. So that's kind of where my heart for this came. I went to the Master's University for my undergrad. It was the Master's College at the time, studied biblical counseling there. Went to Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, got an MDiv in Christian Ministries. While I was there, I worked for Stuart Scott. Many of you might know Stuart. He was a professor of mine at Master's, and then I was his professor's assistant for 3 semesters at Southern when he first landed. I finished that in 2007, went back west to do ministry, and then in 2014, I started a PhD in biblical counseling at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. And my primary area of interest that I wanted to do was post-traumatic stress disorder, and then also broadening, bringing elements of empirical research to biblical counseling that just hasn't been there historically. Not because I think it's necessary, but I think it's an additional tool that we can use in our toolbox to convince people that God's way of handling problems is the right way of handling problems. And I think that should bear out in the fact that when people cooperate with Scripture, their lives change, and that there's evidence of that change. So, but I had a lot of people telling me, one, biblical counselors don't do empirical research, and two, you'll never find a population of people who have post-traumatic stress disorder that'll let you work with them. And God's in the business of doing the impossible, and He opened up doors for both. And I'll explain a little bit more of that as we go through, but I've been researching and gathering data on a particular program called the Mighty Oaks Warrior Program. Specifically their legacy program for men. It's a week-long intensive inpatient program is how it would be described in the secular world, but it's basically man camp for a week that's focused around discipleship and evangelism. And I'll explain some of that, how that flows out throughout the day. That's who I am, why I'm interested in post-traumatic stress disorder. Whether you choose to listen to me, I don't care, but I pray that the Lord would open up your eyes through His Word to some truths that we'll talk about today. Any questions on any of that to begin with? Okay, good. All right, so this morning, we're going to start with introduction to post-traumatic stress disorder. We'll take a break. Rachel will go into complex PTSD, go to lunch. I'll come back and talk about combat trauma specifically. We'll have a case study in the afternoon, a dinner Q&A, and then I'll close out the evening with a time called Demystifying PTSD. You'll notice on the introduction here, there's a word missing. Anybody recognize what word is missing?
Disorder.
All right, very good. Just so you know, we have some gifts today. Everybody will get a chance to leave with the book today, all right? The question is whether or not you'll get to choose which book that is. And I will give out, and I'll let Rachel give out prizes based on people's preference throughout the day. But you all answer at the same time, so that one doesn't count. I'll explain throughout the day, and I will use the terms interchangeably just because, but my preference is to talk about post-traumatic stress, or PTS. And I'll explain why that is throughout the day, but the disorder is going to be missing here intentionally, and I'll explain why. But it is a very helpful thing. It's not just a functional dropping of that word, but it's a helpful dropping of that word when you're dealing with counselees who wrestle with the phenomenon that we're going to talk about. So PTS, what is PTS? First of all, historically, 1980 is not that far in the history of this world. I was born that year, so I like to think about it as not being very far away. But this is the first time that the word post-traumatic stress disorder, the phrase post-traumatic stress disorder, became a recognized psychological diagnosis in the what's known as the DSM-3, or the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Psychological Disorders, Volume 3. And if you've been in counseling, you've been around psychology any amount of time, you've probably heard the DSM. They're up to the 5th edition, so it's now the DSM-5. There was nothing defining this phenomenon that we're going to talk about in that diagnostic manual until 1980. But does that mean that this thing didn't exist before that? Absolutely not. It came into the in 1980 primarily because of research that was done by the Department of Veterans Affairs with veterans of Vietnam. You had this massive population of veterans coming back, into the United States and into a culture that had grown in its understanding and thinking in the world in a psychological way. Right? If you go back in the history of psychology, when it started really taking root in our culture and stuff, it probably wouldn't have had the emphasis and the ability to get that much attention until World War II, people were starting to think along those lines. But Vietnam was the first major military conflict where the veterans were coming back and there was a kind of a mental health community and mental health culture. So people had recognized that, man, these guys who go through really intense issues in combat, they have some issues, it seems like, or there's some distinct differences that they're facing. But it wasn't until, like I said, post-Vietnam, you had the VA has a pretty well-established research program going on. Mental health is becoming it's something they're concerned about more than just the physical disabilities the veterans are dealing with. And you have all these researchers, so they start studying and they came up with this idea of PTSD, or they labeled it and they defined what it means. But the phenomenon has existed, as I mentioned before, since human beings sinned and then began hurting each other. Working backwards in history, you would have seen terms like battle fatigue. Some of the symptoms were described in Vietnam era as berserking. This guy's going crazy in the battlefield. Shell shock, soldier's heart. You know, if you pick it up in fictional literature, secular literature, the red badge of courage. Even it talks about people in the Civil War era who had this separation, this almost lost deadness emotionally to them. And even as far back as the Iliad, there was a researcher who was fundamental in the founding of PTSD as an idea, a VA researcher, who wrote a book called Achilles in Vietnam. And he really compares some of the reactions that Homer describes of combat veterans in the Iliad, predating the New Testament, to the reactions that he was seeing in soldiers off the battlefield in Vietnam. So you see this long historical record of some type of phenomenon occurring to people who experience extreme trauma. And in particular, like I said, it was highlighted to combat because of the readily available comparison, I think. When you see a massive group of people coming back and a large number of them have this thing going on, it's a little easier to pick up on than maybe the individual who was attacked in a crime or an assault. So I think that's probably why it's been associated with the military for so long. But as I mentioned, it's a human issue. And Scripture, I will argue, as well, is full of trauma. And I think even in certain cases describes similar phenomenon to what we would describe as post-traumatic stress in individuals in the Bible. So let me ask you this. Let me just think for a moment. We don't get these details, but what would you have thought if you were Eve? Let's say we don't know for sure who found Abel, right? But could you imagine as a mother walking up on your son and seeing his dead body lying on the ground, never having seen death other than an animal that was sacrificed for your own sin, and then finding out it was your other son who did it? What would that do to your soul? Or think about Noah. Why was it that Noah gets off the ark, sacrifices to God, sees this rainbow, and then immediately what does he do? What's the first... I mean, obviously it took some time, but what did he do? He plants a vineyard, makes wine, and gets blackout drunk. Why did Noah, this man of righteousness, this man of God, who was selected by God for just his family to go on this ark when all the thoughts of men's hearts were continually evil all the time, this guy gets picked, builds an ark that takes over 100 years, and then after everything goes on, he gets drunk. It's one of the first things he does. It's recorded for us in Scripture. Why is that? Well, put yourself in Noah's shoes. You know, we oftentimes see nurseries that are painted with this beautiful ark scene, right? It's like blue skies, green grass, animals coming out, ark on the rainbow. Everything's happy and beautiful. I don't know if you saw the movie Noah with Russell Crowe a few years back. Serious theological issues. But I think they tap into a couple of things that were probably more a little bit more realistic. Like, what was the nature of man? If Genesis 6 is accurate and all of man's intentions of his heart were wicked always, it probably looks a little bit more like what that movie depicts the world being than this beautiful nursery wall that we have. And then you have a flood that destroys almost all life on earth. If you've ever been around somebody who's in intense suffering or going through trauma, you've heard screams, crying, tears, anguish. We don't get all the details, but imagine what was going on around that ark as the floodwaters were rising. And I don't know if the ark was soundproof, but I doubt it was. And besides, whether or not they heard the screams, they knew every bit of life outside this floating wood box is gone. What does that do to your soul? So you just think about it, and then you walk through Scripture, all the different trauma. We'll talk more about some of the trauma that takes place in the Bible. But you begin to see people's reactions. Look at Saul, look at David, and we'll do a case study of them where we compare their reactions. But later on, but Saul goes paranoid. He just gets really paranoid about David, and he does some crazy things, or other people. And there's no, you know, obviously we're not going to go reverse diagnose them into post-traumatic stress, but why is David up all night long crying, soaking his bed with tears? If you take out the trauma of David's life, what was there to instigate that? Before, I mean, obviously there's suffering, there's all these other things, but think about that. What would that have played into his years? So 1980 was the point where there was the world labeled a particular phenomenon, but this phenomenon has existed for all of fallen human history. So a definition for, to step back and say, a diagnosis, this is a definition from the DSM of what they would call post-traumatic stress disorder. A diagnosis of PTSD requires that a person suffer from a number of symptoms following exposure to, quote, actual or threatened death, serious injury, or sexual violence. The person will experience various forms of intrusive symptoms, distressing dreams, involuntary distressing memories, psychological and physiological distress with exposure to certain stimuli. They will persist in avoiding stimuli that might remind them of the trauma they experienced. They also face negative alterations in cognition and mood. And I'll go into each of these a little bit, so don't feel like you need to copy all this data. Negative alterations in cognition and mood, so inability to remember key aspects of the trauma or traumatic event, negative emotional states, decreased desire to participate in significant activities, isolation, estrangement, and then another category, alterations in arousal and reactivity. This is hypervigilance, sleep disturbance, exaggerated startle response, and etc. These symptoms must persist for at least 1 month and cause significant impairment in social, occupational, or other important functions, and not be linked to any psychological effects of substance use or other medical condition. It must manifest over 1 month after a traumatic event. So that's kind of the definition of PTSD from the secular perspective. So breaking it down a little bit, post, it happens after the trauma. So if somebody, it goes through something immediately and immediately is going through some of the symptoms that we associate with PTSD, but those go away, that would be more considered an acute traumatic stress reaction. It's the post is what we're going to latch onto in post-traumatic stress. And post means anything from immediately after, a month after, to maybe these things don't manifest for 30, 50 years later. Sometimes this happens with people. Some people will be seemingly unaffected by it for years and years and years. I've worked with different police officers, first responders, and others who don't have any struggle with the phenomenon that we see in post-traumatic stress until after they retire. And they'll be seeing, I mean, they might see murder scenes, car accidents, fatal car accidents, all kinds of things. They might be assaulted. They might be involved in shootings. And you don't see any of these things come up. But when they retire and when they're no longer, I've had a number of them describe it like they're just shoving one thing down on top of the other, and one experience shoves the other down further and further and further, and they don't have time. I mean, just survival in that field, you don't have time to sit and process and think. But when they stop, they've got all this time. They've got all this blank, idle mind stuff going on, and these things start to come back. I just had a friend who retired from being in police on the police force for over 30 years, and I told him ahead of time, I just said, look, brother, I don't know what's going to happen. Everybody responds differently to these things. I just want to let you know. Pretty common thing is that when you might not have had any nightmares before, you might not have had any intrusive memories or worries about this before, but just so you can be on your guard, it might start now. And he came to me a few months later and he said, I really appreciate you telling me you're right. He said, driving by this one freeway has never bothered me before, but every time I drive by it now, I remember that incident. Or, yeah, I've never slept well because of shift work, but now I'm having these memories, these dreams of this event or this incident or that scene. I mean, yes?
Is it kind of like say you have an accident or somebody dies or something and you're so busy dealing with the situation, and then when things calm down,
yeah,
and you have time, you have to kind of go back to normalcy, and mm-hmm, then the problems with, is that what you're saying?
Sometimes, yeah, oftentimes that is what will happen.
Okay.
Especially, and we'll talk a little bit about the physiology of it in a little bit, but God created us thankfully with the fight or flight system, and when that kicks in, honestly, it's like certain parts of our brain take over other parts of our brain, and we don't think. And once the emergency settles down, we're able to think and process, and that's when things can really start. And for people who are living in that day-to-day emergency, or maybe not the emergency constantly, but if you're a police officer, if you're a veteran in a combat theater, if you're a wife in an abusive relationship, if you're kind of always on edge, because you never know what's going to happen next or when something could happen. And that even that level of stress can push down the time and the ability to process things. And then once that stress is removed and you have the time to process, then all kinds of other things can happen and come up. So, yeah, good question. So that's the post element, the traumatic element. It involves exposure to something traumatic. So what do we mean by traumatic? There is a question of definition of trauma. Is trauma the event, or is trauma the result of the event? And I think I will lean more towards trauma as the result of the event. The root of the word is a Greek word that means wound. And we've talked about trauma. So that's why you have trauma units in the hospital. Somebody's coming in, they've gone through an intense immediate experience, and they have a catastrophic type of wound. There's a cut, a gouge, a hole, a massive bleeding, something. If you apply that more to the soul, there's a wounding of the soul that takes place in traumatic events. But it is important to limit, I think, the definition. The DSM and the world will limit it to, well, it's beginning to expand, but to the actual or perceived threat to life or limb, or sexual abuse, it's serious injury or sexual violence or death, actual or threatened. And it's of you or somebody who's immediately close to you, like immediate family members or really close friends. And this can even be, they'll diagnose PTSD for somebody who hears. So if I'm not, maybe I'm not physically there, but I get a phone call and somebody tells me why my wife was just killed in a car accident. And I, like, it wounds me deeply, right? It should. And then I can develop these phenomena where I don't want to go in a car, or I don't want to drive down that highway where it happened. I never saw it. I maybe never even saw the accident scene. I intentionally didn't look at the photos, but I still know in my mind that's where it happened when I drive by. So I might take totally entirely different routes to avoid it. I might just stop going to be around people entirely. That's a similar phenomenon. And I didn't actually experience the event, but I heard about somebody close to me going through that. So all of these different things. Now, one of the problems with this is that this definition is somewhat arbitrary, and there are people who are trying to expand it to make it completely subjective. So what? And in part, I understand where this is coming from, because people respond to the same trauma differently. Two veterans could be in the exact same firefight and have completely different reactions. So there's an element of subjectivity here, but now people are trying to broaden it beyond this to say anything that, if you think it's traumatic, then that's it. So if your cat gets an infection and that bothers you, and you start responding in these different ways, then you could be, some people want to diagnose you with post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's important, I believe it is important to try to classify what this is. And I want to reiterate, this is not a military problem, because you realize all of those things, threat or actual or perceived threat of death, serious injury, or sexual assault, happens to everybody everywhere. You can get a serious injury slipping on the ice outside. You could be driving down the highway and get in a major accident. You could have somebody break into your house. You could... This is not a military issue. This is a life issue. Just want to continually highlight that. But it does eliminate. It's interesting. The DSM says if you expose yourself to video games or violence in movies and other things like that, it would not qualify. And we'll talk about why that is in a little bit. But think about it. I'm not a horror movie guy, but I've heard about these movies, the Saw movies. I mean, just horrific, grotesque stuff being played out on screen, right? If I go to that voluntarily and watch that, it may be worse than anything I'll ever see in life. But because I voluntarily exposed myself to it, it wouldn't classify me for a post-traumatic stress disorder type of thing. If I went through the actual events that are taking place or knew somebody who did, then it would. Why is that? And we'll talk about why. There's an interpretive issue with the trauma that's going on that makes it affect the soul. We want to be careful not to broaden the definition of the trauma too far, but we also want to be sensitive to the fact that there is some subjectivity here, because some people are going to respond differently to the same things. It's also important to recognize, I want to take away the concept that PTSD is always related to an event, okay? A lot of times people will think of a particular event, and I've mentioned some of those. You know, if you get in a shooting, if you're in a combat situation, if you're in a car accident, if you're assaulted, sometimes that's an individual event, but sometimes it's a long exposure to repeated traumas, and that's what Rachel's going to touch on in complex PTSD. But there's also a growing understanding that we need to think more about people who are living in high stress situations constantly, who may never actually see a trauma, but their bodies and their minds are responding in a similar way to people who actually go through a traumatic event. This was highlighted for me initially when I met some friends of mine who went to seminary together. They went on the mission field. They're in a country where ISIS is active, and she's this tiny, petite, blonde gal with a couple of adopted Ethiopian kids. So she stands out like a sore thumb. And you hear about it, and you know what ISIS is doing to people. And you know what ISIS does to Christians. And you know what ISIS... So you're thinking, she's constantly thinking about the hazards and the dangers that are around. And they were home on furlough, and I got together with them, and I saw her. And she had the same kind of blank stare, the same tiredness, the same, all these other things as a lot of the combat veterans that I had worked with. And I thought, I just asked her, are you okay? You know, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. And she just said, I haven't even had a chance to really relax, because I'm coming out of these years of being in this field where I'm constantly living in this high level of alert. Or the veteran who's in a combat theater, driving on roads where IED blasts take place all the time, hearing about his brothers being killed and all these things, he's constantly living in this high level alert. Even though he never is attacked, he never is engaged, he comes back and he has all these symptoms. And because he never went through combat, the VA is not going to give him treatment for post-traumatic stress because he doesn't have what's called a verifiable stressor. So we need to remove in our minds the idea that PTSD or the phenomenon of post-traumatic stress is just related to an event. One of my dear friends, Chad Robichaud, who's the founder of this Mighty Oaks program, says in his own testimony, he saw combat. He saw lots of different... He was a police officer and a force recon marine, and he saw very traumatic events, both in his police service as well as on the combat field. And he'll say, it wasn't a moment that I struggled with. He was eventually discharged from the military because of severe post-traumatic stress disorder. He started having panic attacks, losing long blocks of memory. One point he realized, I don't know what's happened in the last 2 weeks. And he was in theater in Afghanistan, and he just finally realized, I am endangering everybody else around me. I need to get out. So he blew his cover. He was undercover. He blew his cover, got extracted, diagnosed with severe PTSD, discharged from the Marines. And he'll say it wasn't a particular event. It was just constantly living at this level of and thinking about, what if they catch me? What are they going to do? Are they going to skin me? He was actually working in a building where the Taliban had tortured people, and he would work out in the basement where there were hooks hanging from the wall where they used to hang people, torture them for hours, and then execute them. And he would work out down there because it gave him the anger and the drive, and he's just a beast of a physical guy. Ends up becoming a world champion MMA fighter when he gets out. Crazy, crazy testimony. But anyway, but those thoughts running through his mind, what if, is what he said really led to his wrestling with post-traumatic stress. So we need to realize there are traumatic events, traumatic things that usually take place, but it's not just one event or just these major incidents. It can have a variety of different causes, in a sense.
Curtis.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Help me define the lines of seeing somebody that appears to have these symptoms.
Right.
Because you're describing the event as mostly physical, whether it's life and death or sexual. Yeah. Are there other traumatic events that would put somebody in this category that aren't physical or sexual? And if not, what does the DSM call that?
Yeah, and the I don't think so, and I think I think it needs to, in a sense, be, well, no, not entirely. I'll talk about it a little bit. There's something that's a growing understanding of what's called moral injury. The military is trying to separate where there's a serious violation of some core held belief that can cause somebody to react in similar ways. But there's actually we'll talk about it when I get to combat trauma a little bit more. There's more of a guilt, shame thing associated with that. So for now, I think it's helpful that there is a tying it to a physical, a threat of something. I would, if I was going to expand the definition of anyway, I would say it's a threat to something that is deeply held love. Whether that be my life, my body, or somebody else I love, or some belief or something else that I.
Because for instance,
yeah,
a job,
yeah,
the threat of being fired,
yeah,
the threat of being wrongly accused of plagiarism, mm-hmm. anything that's we could easily categorize it as a traumatic event. Are you saying those things don't qualify for what we're discussing?
I would say that, well, as far as if the in the APA's understanding and definition as it stands right now, it would not qualify for a diagnosis of PTSD. I think there, and that's where I think that we need to, and I'll mention here in a moment, that it is a flexible definition. It's been changed multiple times, and I think there's, especially as biblical counselors, that clues us into something that we need to think deeply about this better, and try to understand it from a biblical perspective. But most people going through those kind of threats aren't going to have the same type of phenomena of intrusive memories, flashbacks, other things like that. And that's where I think that there is a line here between those who are living in high stress all the time and what that stress is caused by, and those who have actually gone through or seen or heard about a traumatic event. And I do think a traumatic event should be something like a life or limb issue. Yeah.
I would like to add to what he's saying, that it might not be a situation like he's, you know, referring to, but these types of things can manifest if a person has had trauma, and then some underlying things such as, for instance, I have a child that has dyslexia, and her struggles sometimes with school, you know, become, you know, evident, and she's stressed out, whatever, but the underlying thing goes back to the trauma.
Yeah.
And it's like these types of things, these other things are things that she can kind of put her hand on and say, it's this, but, you know, it usually, as the conversation goes, it spirals back down to the trauma.
So I still think, that's where I do think, and this is where it is sticky, especially when you start saying, are there lines we can draw? I think we want lines. We want clear distinctions. We want structure and be able to put things into a box. And human life is not that way. And PTSD and post-traumatic stress is definitely not that way. But I do think it is important for us to distinguish because of the... And this is where you run the risk of slippery slope kind of arguments and stuff. You don't want to broaden the category to be just anything you perceive as traumatic, because me breaking my iPhone, that's where in that danger of just saying anything that I truly love and hold dear. I mean, if you make people take away their iPhone, they're gonna freak out. Some of them, you know, you had a 14-year-old whose life is lived on their phone, and they get smashed. I don't want to say that that's a traumatic event. They might feel like it is, and another reason for not doing that is what should be truly valued, right? And this is where a biblical worldview, a biblical understanding helps us to define what should be traumatic, because it is a threat or an actual loss of something that is truly valuable and important to us. But the scripture helps us define what is and should be truly valuable to us.
Yeah. That's very helpful. If I could, without falling off schedule here, I'm thinking about kids of divorce. Mm-hmm. Would that qualify as a traumatic event underneath this category? Daycare.
Yeah. It's not. I mean, you're still. If I'm thinking as a biblical counselor, I'm not going to classify that as a Well, yeah. And on one sense, it is. You're losing something that is extremely valuable and should be very valuable to you.
And biblically would be.
And biblically would be, right. I'll have to think about that a little bit more, because there's still a difference between mom and dad divorcing and dad dying. I'm going to get back to the schedule for the sake of time. But I think that's a really important question, and why we need to keep thinking through this more. Yeah, Jeff.
So it might change how you categorize. Does it change how you would counsel based on that?
No, and I think, well, so let's talk about really extreme cases.
Yeah.
One of the symptoms that can be really extreme is what's called in secular terminology a dissociative episode. So what I was describing with my friend Chad, where he's either completely blacking out and not remembering moments of time, or where they relive the traumatic event over and over and over, and will physically even sometimes act out. I was talking to this other veteran, great brother, who has seen amazing growth in his life, but he still wrestles with panic attacks, where one time his daughter got a cut on her hand, and she started crying. It was a minor cut, but this is after he's come back from deployment. He froze and then freaked out, fell down, had a panic attack. He completely blacks out. He doesn't remember anything. He says, one moment, I remember going to her, hearing her crying, and seeing the blood on her hand. And the next moment, I'm waking up, and there are EMTs around, and everybody's, you know, and one of the things that complicated it for him is one of the EMTs happened to be a guy who was in a unit that was in Afghanistan when he was there. And so it confused him even more, but he's hallucinating back to the battlefield. And I asked him, well, what triggered it? What was it? What do you think was the thing you associated? Oftentimes there's a trigger that's associated to that. And for him, any kid screaming because of a thing that he went through when he was overseas is what is the trigger to an event and a time that he was exposed to there. Most kids who go through a divorce aren't going to have a disassociative episode related to that traumatic event, because the trauma of divorce is not as, and this is where it is complex, because we're going to talk about how it's not just an event. There's a separate, so how I would handle the counseling him who's going through panic attacks and disassociative episodes is going to look different than a child who's wrestling with the loss of unity in their family. But there's still a wound to the soul, so to speak, from your parents divorcing. And I think anybody would realize that. So, I'll have to think about that a little bit more. And I don't claim to have it all figured out by any stretch. So, but I think that's a helpful way to categorize it. And I do think it is important that we try to define what is trauma, what is a traumatic event. Yeah, Ron, and then I'd really need to get back to you.
I think I heard you say actual or perceived, and now it feels like we're backing off of perceived a lot.
No, what I mean perceived, or maybe threatened is a better one. Somebody, you walk around the corner, a dark alley, somebody pulls out a gun and sticks it to your head. They pull
it. Is actual?
Well, hang on a second. They pull the trigger and you're wounded, you don't die. That's an actual serious injury. They pull the gun, they stick it to your head, they don't actually pull the trigger. They rob you and they leave. The traumatic event is a threatened loss of life or a threat of a serious injury, right? So it didn't actually happen, but there was a real threat of it happening. Does that help?
Should I remove perceived?
Yeah, maybe threatened is a better way of thinking, but perceived.
Perceived could almost go to phobias, you know, but threat.
Yes.
Makes it more specific, I think.
But, yeah.
It can be, that's one of my notes. So when like a threat is perceived, so like what he was saying, like the opportunity of somebody kind of holding you up on gunpoint, then there's this activate, like it kind of, your brain starts to activate kind of your survival center, like fight or flight. And then it kind of shuts down. You know, we're primed for survival, and so it may not necessarily be that you're actually dying, but it's like you're thinking about the in Mark 4, right, when the disciples are in the boat and there's this great huge storm, and it's pretty terrifying, right? And they're saying, hey, we're gonna die, we're dying, you know, and they actually weren't dying. Jesus was there, right? He rebukes the winds and the waves and then rebukes them. But it was terrifying. It was a terrifying event, but they weren't actually dying. But it was their perception of the reality that they had that they were dying. Does that make sense?
So somebody might come up to you. This happened to my wife. Somebody came up behind her with a fake knife, held it to her neck, you know, grabbed her in a hold and held it to her neck or whatever. But they were messing around. They weren't actually threatening her life. It was an idiotic supervisor at her job who was just stupid. But her perception of the threat is real, even though the threat wasn't real. Does that make sense? So it was hard. And she didn't, you know, it's not been something that's been a major issue, but for a while, being at her job was difficult, especially if she's closing down at night when she's, but, you know, and whatever. So I think that helps with the perception thing. All right. Trying to get back on track, maybe. There's also the symptom clusters. I mentioned them in the definition, but just to highlight them, there's intrusive symptoms. Those are the unwanted and involuntary, I think, are the helpful things there. Because you can have involuntary memories that are pleasant, right? But you can also have unwanted and involuntary memories. Nightmares, the memories or flashbacks, panic attacks, and then the dissociative episodes, which I talked about a minute. Avoidance. People will try to stay away from things that will remind them of the trauma. So they may be able to identify particular triggers, or they may not. And this is one of the reasons that leads into isolation, which is part of the next cluster. But so, for instance, there was a lady I knew who was sexually abused over and over and over as a child. It's usually by one particular person. And there was a particular place that it happened that happened to have a type of bedding. So she could not stay at hotels because the hotels usually had the same type of bed blanket as where she was molested. That was a trigger for her. So the first time she tried to stay in a hotel room, there's no threat, she panicked. Because for her, that's an identify. She knows that's a trigger, so she just avoids that type of fabric. I knew a veteran who was involved in an IED attack. He's driving down the highway, explosion. In his visual field at the time of the explosion was a red car. I don't even think it was the car was associated with the attack. It just happened to be in his visual field. So now, when he's driving down a highway and he sees a red car in the corner of his eye, his fight or flight system gets kicked on. He begins to panic. And he didn't know that initially. It wasn't, the first few times it happened, he couldn't figure out why this was happening because he wasn't associating red car panic. His limbic system, his fight or flight system, we'll talk about in a moment, had embedded that memory without his active knowledge. So it happens without them knowing. So what that tempts them to do is to isolate. Because if I don't know when or where or how I'm going to have this freak out, it is not safe for me to be outside of where I'm comfortable and where I know. So it can lead to intense isolation, which leads into the next one, negative alterations in cognition and mood. It is hard to think. It's hard to focus. There's oftentimes depression associated with it, lack of desire to participate in activities, especially things that they used to find great pleasure in, isolation and estrangement. We'll talk about why some of those things come out and the interpersonal relation issues that come up with this. And then there's the alterations in arousal activity. This is hypervigilance, sleep disturbance, exaggerated startle response. So hypervigilance, one example would be the guy who gets up every hour at night to check the locks on the door. He's checking the perimeter. You know, a veteran who is on teams where you're on guard, you have to check the perimeter every so often. So even though he knows the last hour he got up, walked around, and checked all the doors, he's going to wake up and he's going to walk around and check all the doors again. The startle response, you know, so if somebody comes up and touches you from behind and you just scream, freak out, curl up in a ball on the floor, or turn around and punch them in the face. Like, it's an exaggerated startle response. That's what we're talking about. People, you've seen movies or TV shows where a car backfires and veterans just hit the ground. Like, that's how it was oftentimes portrayed. So sometimes that's how it comes out. And so what do they do? They don't want to be in public areas. They don't want to be around other people. If they are, they want to sit with their back to the wall where they can perceive, feel like they see everything that's going on around them. When I worked at the VA, we maybe inappropriately but jokingly called, they gave all these people mirrors because you're in a cubicle where your desk is facing a corner and there's an opening behind you. And they gave everybody mirrors so you could see if somebody walked. And we jokingly called them PTSD mirrors. Because there were a lot of veterans that worked at the VA, and there were some that you legitimately did not want to sneak up on. Or not, maybe not even trying to sneak up on, but you wanted them to know they were there, you were there, and not surprise them because of this exaggerated startle response. So, and then disorder, and this is where I'm going to argue for dropping it, but the reason it's included from a secular standpoint, a disorder is anything that causes you to not be able to function normally in society. So that means you're not able to hold down a job, you're not able to have normal relationships. Then that gets identified as a disorder because it's unwanted. You don't like that. It's abnormal, quote unquote. But one of the reasons I'm going to argue against labeling a disorder is because because of the way that we perceive disorders in our world, the way we talk about them, it identifies you as broken, as a freak, as weak, as you have a problem, as though you're abnormal. And really, what I'll argue is that PTSD is a natural response to unnatural circumstances, not an abnormal response to normal circumstances. Right? It's a normal response to abnormal circumstances, not an abnormal response to normal circumstances. And if you think about it, if somebody is, it's more, in one sense, it is more disturbing to find somebody who can see the things that human beings can do to one another and not be bothered by it than the person who sees the horrors that sin enables in this world that is bothered by it. As I mentioned, this is an ever-evolving definition. So one author recently, he proposed the idea of developing a spectrum disorder, kind of like autism spectrum disorder now, because of the differences and variations of the symptoms as well as the levels of these symptoms. You know, somebody's having... So there's a lot of speculation. It's an ever-evolving definition. Each edition of the DSM has changed the way it's been defined and talked about. So, physiological understanding. This is, as Rachel brought up, the normal. God created us. Praise his name with a fight or flight response. We're all familiar with it. We've all been through it. Even if it was just your husband playing a joke on you when you're walking down the hallway and he jumps out and you go, blah, you startle, and there's a physiological reaction to that. Your blood pressure is going to shoot up. Your pores are going to open. You're going to start to sweat. Adrenaline is going to kick, you know, your brain actually activates hormones that kick in your kidneys or the adrenal glands above your kidneys to shoot off adrenaline into your system so that your muscles and your whole body is flexed and ready to run away or to kill whatever is threatening you. And if it's your husband, I pray that you resist that urge. But that happens really without our knowledge. Right? It's not as though you see somebody come around a corner and jump at you and you think, what I need to do now is make my heart rate shoot up, blood pressure increase, get some adrenaline in my muscles and go. It just happens. And that's normal. Our bodies God designed our bodies that way, and it's a beautiful thing. So praise the Lord for that. Here's a little diagram just to show you a little bit of the neurophysiology that's going on here. There's a threat. I see guy with a knife. Again, is this your idiotic supervisor threatening you with a fake knife? Or is this somebody who's going to attack you? Your brain initially doesn't know. It sees knife and thinks danger. So what happens is your pituitary gland in your brain, I'm not going to get into all the technical stuff about it, but basically you have these adrenal glands here that's going to do what I said. It's going to eject adrenaline and cortisol into your system. Adrenaline is what kicks your system into high gear, and then cortisol is what counteracts it and helps it to subside back down to normal or sustain your body for a longer lasting stress response. It can actually shut down your internal organ activity so that the blood flow is channeled away from digestion to muscle. So that, because honestly, if somebody's going to kill you, you don't need to digest that steak that you ate last night. You need a muscle to punch him in the face. Praise the Lord. God made our bodies amazing. And this is all going on with different parts of the brain. And you'll note that some key components of this system are happening in here, which is known as the limbic system of the brain. And this prefrontal cortex is where we have our high reasoning, thought, language skills, the ability to think abstractly, other things like that, which is not very involved in the fight or flight response system. And actually, if somebody, when people with post-traumatic stress disorder, this portion of the brain can actually shrink and become less active, where these will grow and become more active. Why is that? You know, there's some chicken and egg questions that still need to be resolved yet, but we see, so I want, one of the things I'd like to communicate to people, because especially with biblical counselors, is we can, sometimes we're tempted to focus on things as just soul issues, and not, and that can cause people to assign blame sometimes where blame is not due. If, but soul issues can affect the body. So sometimes there are sinful responses that we have that will make effects in the body. So we have to wrestle with these chicken and egg types of questions, which causes which. As we get into the counseling process, we can see these phenomena can actually be reversed. The hippocampus and amygdala, or amygdala, depending on where you're from, can shrink back down, and the prefrontal cortex components can grow and become more active. And they've seen this and studied this in secular talk therapy. So praise the Lord, counseling affects the brain. It's amazing. And can obviously affect how we handle things. So a couple things to point to highlight on this is that this fight or flight response engages, because this portion of the brain is also active in memory development, and it happens without knowledge. It happens instantaneously. And that's where these memories are immediately embedded into somebody's brain without their thought about it. So it's not like the guy who's wrestling with pornography. He's voluntarily exposed himself to a whole bunch of images, and sometimes those images are going to come back to him when he's not expecting, not desiring it, and when he's wrestling with it. But he did that to himself, voluntarily. Somebody who's wrestling with post-traumatic stress disorder, if they have a flashback that's triggered by something, they don't even know where that came from. They're not responsible for it. And one guy I was talking to recently about this moral injury thing talked about the fact that the emotions associated with the memory are also embedded in that memory. So when they have the flashback, so this guy was a Navy SEAL, and he was on Overwatch as a sniper, and which means he's covering another unit who's doing something. And this other unit had found these IEDs that were little kids' backpacks, in a particular type of backpack. Well, he's on Overwatch, and he sees some enemy forces, and they have little kids that are wearing these exact same backpacks. And they're trying to get these kids to run to him and to his sniper position and to others. And he's faced with that. If they come, I have to kill them. I'm praying they don't come. He wasn't a believer, so he wasn't really praying, but he just was, don't come, don't come, don't come. But they're crying. These little girls, they know what's going on. They're screaming, they're crying, they're freaking out. Thankfully, they didn't. They ran away. Flash forward, he's at home at his daughter's birthday party. And somebody walks in with a similar backpack. And he said, the memory came back, but he said, well, the thing that was most startling to him was the hatred he felt. He said, because at that moment, when I saw what they were willing to do, I hated them. And that's what invoked in him an extreme anger and hatred. And when that backpack walked in, what I felt was hatred. There's no ISIS, there's no Taliban, there's no none of that. It's a little girl with a backpack. But that emotion was tied to that memory too. So you need to see the entirety of the what's going on in the body, what's going on in the mind, what's going on in the surroundings is all tied in. The mind grabs those things and holds on to them. And that's what God created our minds to do, because it's just like a little kid. If I touch a hot stove and I burn my hand, I may not have the cognitive capacity at age 2 to think stoves create heat, I shouldn't touch hot things. What my brain does is, those things are hot, I'm not going to touch it. Our brains do the same thing, where crazy trauma, injury, damage, pain, I don't like anything that's going on in my sensual sense experience at all. But that includes emotion too. So all of those things are embedded. So when you're counseling somebody, you're going to have to, you want to talk to them about the fact that this PTSD phenomena, or post-traumatic stress phenomena, is a holistic, it's all encompassing. It deals with your will, your desires, your thoughts, your emotions, your body. It affects the entire person. And that's one of the things that's dangerous. The other thing to highlight about this system is it actually is not functioning correctly in people who are wrestling with post-traumatic stress. And this is where some of the distinction will come through. The child who, his parents get divorced, and the person who's been assaulted, is the child's usually, their fight or flight response is not going to be activated in that divorce, typically. So I'm teaching and instructing a bunch of combat veterans in how to do biblical counseling, and there's a guy, he's been sitting on a couch for probably 4 to 6 hours, little breaks in between, talking on his phone. But if I put a blood pressure cup on his arm right then, it is through the roof, because his fight or flight system, his limbic system, is active, even though there's no perceived threat. There is no threat, perceived or actual, around. But he's constantly on edge. And it wears on the body. As I mentioned, it can physically affect the brain, but it also wears on the body. It's kind of like, how many of you ever watched a street racing movie or did some street racing? You don't have to confess street racing. But you guys know what NOS systems are, right? Nitrous oxide. So if you have a souped-up street racer, you have a system that will inject nitrous oxide into the fuel system. It burns hotter, makes the engine run faster. That's like a fight-or-flight system in your brain. Well, what happens if you run the NOS system too long in your car? The engine blows up. It's designed for short bursts of energy, similar to the fight-or-flight system. If it's running constantly, it tears down the body. Or the other thing with post-traumatic stress is it gets activated when it shouldn't get activated. So what happens if you're driving along the road and at every red light you hit the button on your NOS system? You send a bunch of, your engine's just going to rev really high while you're sitting there. And if you do that every red light, it's going to tear down the engine. It's going to break down the engine. So with somebody who's wrestling with post-traumatic stress, their body, their brain, everything is being put through things that it wasn't designed to be put through. Is kind of the point. And so we need to have grace, we need to understand that, and we need to handle that with sensitivity. So that's the physiology of what's going on. The interpretive nature, this is really important. And we'll discuss some of the factors of why different people respond differently to the same stressors later on. But think about this. If you saw a human body and the abdomen, the skin was peeled back and it was laid open and you saw its internal organs, how many of you, that's a normal daily sight? Not usually. Think about this. Is the person on an operating table with surgeons around them, or is it your best friend who just got hit by a mortar? Same, technically the same visual sight, very different context. So we interpret that differently. One includes the desire and the need and the thought of helping. One is hurting. One is voluntarily undergone, usually, unless somebody's in a traumatic accident. You know, if I find out I have cancer and I say, yeah, cut me open, I went through that voluntarily. The other, clearly not voluntary. The person watching it, the person outside, knows the difference. And this is another reason why if I watch Saw, it doesn't affect me the same way as if somebody if I know somebody's actually being held captive and tortured. There's a difference. So there is something to our thought and how we're perceiving the trauma that's going on that affects how we're going to respond to it. And this is another reason, another reason why biblical counseling and counseling can be so helpful in the reprocessing of the trauma to help somebody wrestling with the post-traumatic stress. Was it an accident or was it intention? Was it inflicted by, was it somebody I know, didn't know? Because, I mean, if I hear somebody died in a car accident on I-85, I'm going to feel sad, and hopefully I'm going to pray for that person or their family. But if I hear that it was my son or my wife or my parent, it's going to affect me differently. And it should. So again, there's an interpretive access to this, or a aspect to the post-traumatic stress. Is it something... I'll address that later. All right, so the spiritual component. The spiritual component is going to include different things about... Well, we're going to talk about the spiritual component more, but there is a spiritual component to trauma, and it deals with questions like innocence and guilt. Was I involved in this? Was this a sin that was committed against me? Was this not a sin committed against me? This is when I had a student who submitted a paper on post-traumatic stress disorder, and he said, it's when somebody severely sins against you. And I said, well, what about a hurricane? You know, what about natural disaster that kills my son? Or a car accident that wasn't a drunk driver? That's not a sin. So we need to take that into consideration. But did I sin and cause this to happen? Was God in control or not in control? Almost every single person who goes through a traumatic event later on will report that in the moment they had this extreme sense of being out of control, that they just had no control whatsoever. And that attacks some deeply held spiritual beliefs, either one, that I am in control. A lot of times we're actually walking around thinking we're in control of life when the reality is we're not. And I try to actually help people and point them to the reality that you actually understand and experience life in a greater sense of truth than most of us do. Because the reality is you're not in control of your life. But I can point them to a higher reality that God is in control of their life. That's something we get to a lot later on in counseling with most people. It's not, we don't start with the sovereignty of God, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But that is true. Their perception of the world is probably a little bit better than most of ours, because the world we live in is a scary place. I think David Pallison said at a conference I was at a few years ago, more of us should be freaked out all the time than we are, you know? I mean, depression and anxiety make a lot of sense in a really sinful, fallen world, especially if you don't have God in the picture. But another spiritual component is, if they had a belief in God, where is God? Where was God? Johnny Erickson taught at Pastor Ty and Jess and Rachel and I were just at a summit this past week where Johnny Erickson Tata was talking. She was there and sharing her testimony, and some of the things she wrestled with after she broke her neck were, who's in control, God or Satan? Did God turn his back and Satan stick his foot in my back and shove me off of that raft and cause me to break my neck? Who caused this? Who's in control? These are spiritual questions that people wrestle with. Shame is one issue. Am I weak? Am I broken? Am I damaged? Am I dirty? Am I an animal? Am I a monster? Like, these are all questions that people will have. Was I supposed to be done at 10:15?
Yeah, go ahead and take an extra couple minutes.
Okay.
Because the content is obviously what we're going for. But then we'll take probably a 20-minute break.
Okay, so there's the shame, the identity issue. Am I robbed of who I was or who I am? A lot of guys, especially Marines, will say, I am a Marine. I was a Marine. Now I'm not a Marine. Does that take away from who I am? Shameful thoughts can also turn into identity questions. What I thought I was, I am not no longer that person. A woman who is raped feels dirty and shameful, even though she didn't do anything about it. She didn't choose that. She still feels like I'm damaged goods. I'm no longer pure. And those things can cause identity questions to rise, which are shame and identity are spiritual issues, right? They're not biological. Purpose. This is tied closely to identity. The guy who sees himself as no longer a Marine, his identity as a Marine gave him a reason to live, gave him mission, it gave him purpose. And if I take away my identity, do I have reason to live any longer? If my identity as a Marine is what gave me purpose and I'm no longer a Marine, why should I go on living? Questions relating to purpose can also revolve around the question of purpose for particular events in life, and the question, what was God's purpose? Was there purpose? Is everything arbitrary? Is everything outside of control? And then guilt issues. If the person is at fault, so and these are questions you'll ask your counselee as you're going through the issue, because they'll be wrestling with this. Okay, I'm now paralyzed from waist down because I was in an accident, but I was a drunk driver in that accident. So I'm guilty. I'm responsible for this. Or that person died. My wife died in the car next to me because I was drunk while I was driving. That's going to impact and complicate the issue, and the counseling is going to be different. Steve Vyer's book, Putting Your Past in Its Place, has really helpful categories of innocent past, guilty past, and how do we respond to those situations. And then there's also the mixture. So I, because a lot of my work is with combat veterans, you're innocent in the sense that you are sent as an agent of the state to go and do combat. But if you responded to a particular incident with a desire and a passion for vengeance, then you also have an element of guilt too. So it can be mixed. And sometimes helping people parse that out and then working through confession, forgiveness, reconciliation, things like that can be really helpful. And then I mentioned briefly the issue of moral injury. And I think I'll talk about that more when I talk about combat trauma later, I think. Doubt. Doubting God's goodness. Doubting God's sovereignty. Right? Anytime something really bad happens, that's what people ask, is where was God, or what does this mean about God? Either he's not in control or he's not good. Because if he was in control, he wouldn't let this happen. Or if he was in control, yeah, this shouldn't happen because he's not good. Right? That constant question that happens. And then there's some kind of conflict with a deeply held belief. Life should be this way. One example is a guy, man, I don't think I have time for the whole story, but there's a guy named Matt Meyer who's a captain in the military who went through one of the most horrific battles of U.S. Army history. He had a faith. He claimed to believe in Christ before his military deployment. What he saw on the battlefield conflicted with his theology. His theology was, if I'm a Christian, if I believe in God, then God should bless me, help everything go well in my life, and people like me and other Christians shouldn't get hurt. There was a young man in his unit who was a believer who was killed in that battle, and it just caused this captain to have a huge fracturing of his, and caused him to doubt his faith and doubt God, because that contract that he had, that belief that he had, this is the way God works, came in conflict with reality. So either he jettisons reality or he jettisons his theological belief. Well, what does that mean? It means either he ditches faith in God entirely, or by God's grace, what happened is he got some counsel, ended up actually reading a book by Johnny Erickson Tada talking about the fact that God actually doesn't promise us a good life. He promises us suffering and hardship, helps us reshape that, and his faith is now strong because he realized my understanding of that contract of God is what was wrong, not the reality. So, but some people will jettison reality, or some people will jettison God. But so you can see that this is a spiritual exercise as well.